Welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about how writing works, how writers work, and why the best writers risk being strange. And I'm talking with one of my great writing mentors in my life, Dennis Cooley, who was not my first, but my second creative writing professor ever. My first was Doug Reimer, Dennis. And and Dennis is really the professor who gave me, I think, one of the biggest tools that I still use to this day, which I've talked about before. If you go listen to the other episode that I did with Dennis, he talks a bit more about this topic, which we'll get into a little bit. But he really got me into this idea of mining the site. I was just advising students the other day to do this exact thing, Dennis, in my screenwriting class. This idea that you would find a topic, find something that interests you, and just start digging into it. And then doing draft work and just testing ideas and trying ideas as you kind of are doing that. And I'm curious if you could talk a bit about that process that you have in terms of how you wrote your latest book here, Body Works, which is, you know, divided into these different sections that have sort of a thematic consistency. So I wonder if you could just start, Dennis, maybe by way of introducing yourself and your work to people who don't already know you, if you could just talk a little bit about what Body Works is about, kind of what its sections, kind of how it breaks up, maybe even read a couple poems from it, that we can maybe dig a little bit more deeply into how you wrote and revised those. I know that's a big question, but I really like your process is so interesting to me, and I've stolen so many useful tricks from you over the years. So I love to kind of delve into that whenever we're talking.
Yeah. I think the advantage of doing something such as I do, having some site, some idea, notion, whatever that you build around and build off, is really productive. If you wait for inspiration, you may wait a very long time. It's probably a limited strategy if you're going to be a serious writer. When I say serious, as in not as in solemn, but as in working at it in a way that really matters, taking care with it. In this book, I have actually had a couple of particular occasions that have led me into it. Two traumas in my own life. My body has failed me in several ways. One of them was I was stricken with arthritis years ago. And on another occasion, I had a heart valve replaced. So I thought, well, these are opportunities to write something. So I wrote around them. I wrote a lot of arthritis poems. Most of them were kind of crazy and kooky. Almost none of them survived into the book. But the notion of gathering and building, assembling, disassembling, reassembling stuff around the body. And there, in that case of a traumatized body, but also an aging body, seemed to lend itself rather well to a project. But I also had been working in that sort of thing before. I published a long time ago a book called Soul Searching, which led several people who never read the book but knew the title to think I was writing poems about angels. In fact, I'm writing about bodies, and the bodies come off rather well alongside the souls and spirits. And the same thing happens in this book as well. But there was another one, an intermediary one called Departures, which came from a time when my appendix ruptured. So I wrote a long poem around that. So I've got a kind of history of writing sympathetically about the body. But here, occasioned, well, as the second one was around particular experiences. So I thought, what else have I got? Looked around, what else do I have? What else might I find? One section, the very first section, Time, is almost brand new. The material there was almost wholly written a very short time before the book came out. Some of the other stuff was much older. Some pieces are gathered from earlier books. One came out of the book called Soul Searching. And one of them came out of an earlier book that I published in Germany. So I often do that if I find old poems that seem to lend themselves well to what I'm doing, or that I'm particularly fond of, and they can be improved by rewriting. I grab them up and give them a try. So that's sort of thing I was doing with this. Brought in my research, my travels. I had seen that wonderful clock in Prague, that gorgeous thing, just unbelievably beautiful. And the story about it, that one in public square in Prague, it's an amazing kind of thing to see and to learn about. So I wrote a poem about that. I heard of the fellow who was tuning the clocks in Parliament, and that lent itself rather well. So they became part of that, those timepieces. Oh, you're always watching for something that catches your interest, your enthusiasm, with something that might, in a very loose way, fit. I've got a very generous sense of what will take place in or be included in a manuscript.
Could you talk a bit more about what that kind of process of writing in a sort of recovery state, you know, or how, what process you see writing as playing, or what part role did it play in kind of recovering from those traumatic experiences?
Well, I guess the answer I would think of is probably one that everyone would expect. And it's much what happened for me when I wrote books about my parents' death. I found that strangely comforting and pleasurable. And I've spoken of this to several people, and they've all said, yeah, it's therapeutic, isn't it? And it certainly has been that. And what else it is? I mean, writing, you might argue, is therapeutic, where you're finding something that kind of fits there. You like the rhythm or the how this, you arrive at this at this moment or whatever. So the sheer pleasure of writing anything is there always. But these particular things have probably been therapeutic in one way or another.
What do you think is at the root of that? Do you think it's about reframing the experience or taking control over the experience? Or do you think it's about like just thinking through the experience or sitting with it, allowing yourself to feel about it? Like, I'm always curious to know how people incorporate writing into their life in those sorts of ways.
Yeah. Well, I actually don't spend a lot of time sitting about thinking and contemplating how might you understand or explain things. I'm a plunger in. I'm writing and I'm in moving words around, seeing what happens, looking for something that excites or pleases me. So it's been a pretty internal kind of process for me. It's fairly undirected. I guess I have what you've called a sight, but I don't particularly have an idea about what I've got or how I'm going to see this. Sympathies are there, obviously, and aversions are there in these texts. But there's always sympathy for the material world, a strong sympathy for the material world, and that enters into, say, other texts such as a poem I wrote about the cosmonauts called This Only Home. And there's a strong sense of ecology and a shared life and existence that's precarious, but that's astonishingly beautiful and powerful.
I really love the metaphor of kind of mining a site that, when you taught it to me, at least, I remember, I don't know if you're thinking on this has changed over the years. I mean, this is 20 years ago now, but like when you taught it to me originally, it was very much, what I liked about it was that it was counterintuitive to my own process up to that point. Because so much of my process up to that point had been about, you know, I've got an idea, I'm going to pursue this idea. You know, like, it was, I tend to be a very analytical person, which serves me well in some ways, but with my writing, I was getting frustrated because I was starting to really force my ideas onto the work, and it would kind of push back in ways. And I felt like there was a sort of way in which a lot of what I was doing at the time was feeling inauthentic in some level, even though it was expressing kind of what I wanted to express. I was almost dissatisfied with that. And what I liked about your approach is it was much more exploratory. It was much more about, yeah, just diving in and seeing what's there. And it gave me kind of a license or permission to kind of, just to do more research, which is something I enjoyed and kind of really satisfy my curiosity, but also just to sort of figure out what I even thought or felt about these things rather than kind of predicting what I should say. I found it became much more, my writing process since taking that class and kind of learning this concept from you has become much more about trying to see where the idea wants to go and trying to really serve the story or serve the poem and kind of go to the end of where it, at the end of the idea is the sort of way I always like to frame it. What I find in your work, how it plays out in some ways, is that you get this very kind of embodied sort of poetry. It's interesting that you call this body works, and so much of it is about the body and, exploring that, what it means to have a body and so on. Because something that's always been true in your work is that it's kind of played off the breath and like the pacing of the natural way that you might read a line or how you might break a word and so on. I'm curious if you just take a moment to just read one of these poems to sort of show people listening kind of what I mean.
Sure. Let's see if this one works. Traveling Light. It plays off the old story of the Greek mythic figure who's lost his wife. She's been bitten by a snake into the underworld. He goes in search for her, coming back with her, but loses her when he looks back. Traveling light, reaching out to touch his wife. She wasn't there the time he yanked through his sleeve the scarf that he dropped on the way back. The bodies we hold in casual delinquency as a matter of light occupancy, as if time did not go all the way through, as if we were not fireflies in a jar or the breath of gravity. So the end slows the pacing in that lineation too, which readers could see, I suppose, if they had it in front of them.
People look at your poems in front of them, you're moving, using the page quite a lot often. I mean, more or less, depending on the book. You'll break words often in the middle, to kind of accentuate, often to break like a compound word up and get a doubled meaning out of it, or you'll use line breaks very extensively in an interesting way. You've written actually what I consider to be the best essay on line breaks, breaking and entering, I often will teach that essay to people, because you just literally catalog how a poet might break lines and why. You don't necessarily, argue for yours being the best practice per se, but you kind of like move through that intentionality of why poets might do this or that or the other thing, which I think is just a really useful tool for writers. But what I like a lot about your kind of approach in the book and in your books is you have a style that is yours, but you're not afraid to kind of alter it and shift it, like so many people get trapped in a style, I find, over the years. I'm curious to know more about how you developed that approach, though, because I know you came to this writing professionally in a way somewhat later in life.
Well, by the time I decided I'm actually a writer and thought maybe I might be, I had already done a lot of work. I had been a graduate student and done a dissertation on Robert Duncan and taught poetry for several years and edited it for several years with Turnstone, at that time a young press. And I wrote about poetry. So I'd done a lot of thinking about it. I argue that reading poetry well is very close to writing it. You have to have very similar sense of respect for language, awareness of rhythm, of the kind of resonance and multiplicity that you could be working with as a writer, as a reader, you know, and respect the kind of demands and rewards that poetry offer to you. So I had a kind of done in some ways a kind of preparation, certainly, if not an apprenticeship. And so when I started writing, I felt pretty confident that, about what I was doing, that I had developed a bit of savvy about the techniques and the strategies in writing. So I got going pretty quickly, though I told the story before. Maybe I told you this story. My first book, I was just a little guy that came out. I was pleased the book was there, but I was also panicked a little bit because I thought, that's it. I used up all my poems. I have no more poetry. So that was a long time ago and many books ago, but I did have that panic feeling that there were no more. But part of it is not waiting for an occasion for something to happen to you. Those things happen. I strongly believe in inspiration. But that's not enough. If you don't have the skill and care, and maybe more importantly, the capacity to just hang in there, endure, that's really important. I mean, not just for a half an hour here or a week there, but for years and years to work on a body of writing. I remember Coach talking about that. His phrase was, you got to have a plan. And he did work that way, actually, to the surprise of many people. I don't particularly have a plan other than to keep writing.
And how do you teach that? Because I find it's a real struggle in my classes to kind of teach what is the most important thing in many ways, which is what you just talked about. Like, there's a level of like, you know, I can teach you this technique, I can teach you this, I can teach you that, I can ask your questions, but there's a level of stick-to-itiveness that's hard to, like, you want to promote it and encourage it, but I find it's in some ways difficult to teach. I'm curious to know how you have approached that over the years when you were, you know, teaching more fully. Like, what do you do when you're in a class and you've got a student who they might have some talent or some promise there, but you can see that they're struggling with like keep still going.
Yeah.
You know, like I know that I myself had an issue with that initially, where it's like I would stop and start a lot. You know, and because I had the idea that I needed, now I've given, I understand better, but initially I had what I think a lot of people have, which is you think that you have to have an idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And ideas may lead you to essays and to statements and arguments, which are exciting and valuable. Absolutely. But they might not lead you to poetry, or at least poetry that has something special, something more than the most bald statement, which usually is not very interesting as poetry. It can be, but tends not to be. But I don't know what you can do other than by implication that somehow attracting students to the writers to the possibility of patience. But it's important. Even over a short period of time, you did a book. Don't expect a world tour this year, you know, or ever perhaps. So part of it is saying, well, the world unfolds or folds as it will, and you might just get on with whatever it is that you're doing.
You've got so many poems that kind of sort of speak to what you were talking about before, where being an attentive reader. Like a lot of your poems, either they obviously come out of you having done some research, you know, or discovered something, like, you know, seen that clock or what it had an experience perhaps. But other times you can tell that, you know, you've been looking into the science of some aspect or you know, you've just been reading something or been thinking about an old story. Like you've got the poem about Ulysses in here. Ulysses, one of my favorite ones in here is Ulysses Returns, which is this sort of moment in the Odyssey, right? Where Odysseus or Ulysses is returning home to Ithaca. And there's so much that happens in that moment in the original story. You sort of start to weft and wend around some of the things that happened there and some of the things that happened previously. You mentioned the sirens in the poem and so on. I'm curious to just know, just as an example of how you construct a poem like this, I wonder if you could just, you know, read that one for us here and just talk a little bit about, if you can remember the details of that. Like, what can you remember about writing that particular poem or even, you know, editing that particular poem?
All right, let me have a go at it. Here's Ulysses Returns. Enough of this. No more, he says. Bye-bye, stealing to buy. Xanthium, this standing by when creatures go by and two by two, rattling their way to extinction. And who are you to rail? This is no country for cold men, their tired coffee bean hearts grinding in an enamel music box or inside an oil rig. There should be dolphins, of course, and whales cruising plankton, their high, mournful songs rising through the wooden boats in an aura around the crew, the stars steady and steering. No question of the sharp wind in our wake, salt air and the smell of tar, the wine, dark seas, no doubt about that, the somber and tormented waters in which the waves bosom with ships and mackerel, and stars furl in pennants and release fires in lapis lazuli. We should expect sirens smack in the middle, singing, come live with us, come alive with us. The same yeast, the same old steamy desire, under a sun that singes and the seas begin to rise and sweat all over again. There should be more of things, the bazaars jammed with goats and garlic, thick with smoke and buzzings and voices that shout or whisper, yes, and if only, the rooms where children sing, the small green birds, the warm touch of mothers. Yeah. So I can think of a few things that are behind the poem and for me, still with the poem. Part of it's almost a revenge stone poem on William Butler Yeats.
I was going to say, there's those, the line of Sailing to Byzantium where you call it the poem, but also you transform that No Country for Cold Men. You transform it into that line. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about that, because the obvious touchstone is Homer's Odyssey, but the Yeats poem is in there. I teach that poem quite a lot as well. I'm curious to know, can you talk a bit more about that particular connection and what's behind it for you there? Yeah.
Well, it may be connected to an essay that I wrote on or book I wrote on Robert Croce. He's in his poem about growing up in Heiser, Alberta. He talks about the little local river, big, not Big Muddy, but the Battle River, just a piddly little river. And he invokes alongside that or against it all these large, magnificent rivers of Europe that are well renowned one way or another. And I remember writing the essay invoking Yeats too, that the monuments of an aging intellect, the Byzantium, this artificial city, it's an astonishing, a wonderful poem. But I'm objecting to that kind of view of the world that sees a fixity and a disembodied existence. Here's the Yeats who laments the loss of the body, the deterioration of the body, but he sees a triumph in this world of enamel gold tracings. So I'm working against that, a very strong sense of embodied world, which you surely get in Homer very strongly there. But I'm also working off a keen sense of ecology. The return here comes to a world that's endangered. Ulysses welcoming the world that he has known. There are the wine, dark seas, and the tar that you hear in all those Homeric poems. But when he arrives, the danger, the the species are rotting away to extinction. And so the poem works on that on the way through until it ends with this kind of affirmation. There should be more of things. With what the bazaars jam with goats and garlic, this very body world of sensations, but then ends on a kind of lyrical note. The rooms where children sing, the small green birds, the warm touch of mothers, which is always been a part of what I've been doing, that those kind of lyrical things. People often don't notice them. I'm not sure why, but that's been there all along. And so we got a kind of range of those kind of voicings in this text.
I think your style has such a, it has such an unaffectedness and a casualness to it that it's easy to overlook the things you're doing that are very affected and very precise. Like, so at the end of that poem, you mentioned once you come back to the bazaars and you're talking about the children singing, I think it's easy to kind of overlook that that's also a callback to the Yeats poem. It's the opposite of what Yeats is praising in Byzantium. You're praising the bazaars rather than the mosaics, et cetera. And then you've got, instead of the Yeats, where he praises the mosaic, effectively there's these paintings that are pretending to sit, that it's the Yeats is envisioning as them being alive and singing, these artworks. And instead, you're presenting the children, these actually alive people in Byzantium that the Yeats is overlooking. In favor of these, timeless, immortal. Eventually, he's going to end up with this robotic, golden bird as the sort of singer, right? So I feel like it's easy to see your, if you're attentive, the kind of reading, it's easy to see your earlier allusions to Yeats, but I think it's harder to see, like, you got much more subtle allusions later on. And I think like that's where sort of maybe sometimes if people aren't, they can get too wrapped up in your style in a certain sense and not really see some of the more subtle things you're doing, at times.
Yeah. And they're small and quiet. Those are little things and kind of domestic things, children singing, mothers, watching out for them.
Yeah, precisely why Yeats isn't talking about them and is, counterpointing them, but exactly, why you might be bringing them back in for that, sort of moment at the end. I always think also of Odysseus. It's not in the poem, but the thing that I always think about when I think about Odysseus returning home is the scene with the dog. Where he's in disguise to people. So people haven't read the Odyssey. Yeah. Odysseus returns home. He's disguised himself as a beggar because everyone's trying to kill him. They think he hasn't returned home, they think he's dead. But if he is going to return home, they're going to kill him because they want to marry his wife and they want to take over his kingdom. And so he's disguised as a beggar, kind of sneaking in to his own castle, more or less. And at one point, his old dog, who is decrepit and recognizes him, recognizes the scent of Odysseus, and Odysseus goes and pets him. The dog is overjoyed, and then almost immediately dies. Has a sort of last sort of moment of pure joy before it passes, and it's this beautiful like little touch in the Homeric poem, which it doesn't really play into your ideas here, so it makes sense that you wanted to have it in the poem. But what I find so interesting about your approach to poetry is you could have easily written a whole book about the end of like Odysseus. You could have taken this poem and expanded it out. Every line you could spin another poem off it, and I've seen you kind of do that sort of approach in other books. And so I'm curious to know, where do you stop with this kind of a process? It's so endlessly generative. It would be very easy, maybe not easy, but it's very possible for you to pick any one of these sorts of places and just keep spinning ideas off of them. And I'm curious to which one, how do you kind of determine which things you're going to focus on in that way to produce something like a whole book of poetry or a whole section inside of a book versus, if there's just like one poem, is it just sort of a natural thing where you're just going where your instinct is kind of leading you? Or are there moments when you kind of decide, okay, I've got this mess of things and I'm going to kind of start whittling it down into something like a manuscript? Like, when do you start, when does kind of a book become, or when does a kind of poem become something larger, like a project for you? And when does kind of like a mass of things start to kind of siphon down to a book?
Well, the burgeoning is easy for me, and a great pleasure. As I say, I enjoy writing, and so I keep doing things, and they show up in various versions and pile up in various sites. The biggest challenge for me is to just say I gotta make some decisions here and move this somewhere if it's ever going to find readers. The current project I'm on, that I'm virtually done, has come from, As For Me, My House, Sinclair Ross's As For Me, My House. I've been working at it since at least 1989. And at the moment, I've got in front of me probably about 400 pages of well-developed poetry that I'm doing up into two books. And I'm at the very end of doing this, but it's taken a long, long time. I keep revising and reading new stuff, abandoning stuff I had, dumping, throwing it out, and it's gone, or throwing it over to the side for a while. So that's the hardest part for me. It's just to stop writing and edit, start editing and sending things out. So I'll write forever.
I love this story. And when you were doing Bloody Jack, you actually put inside the book Arneson coming and taking the book away from you. And I think one of the lines in the poem is, you know, that's enough, Cooley. I'm taking it away and you're done. So, which I understand is more or less what happened, right? And you even put that into the book in 1 year of revisions.
Yeah. Editors are really valuable. It's very hard work for editors to work on texts. It takes so much knowledge and ability and patience and discernment and sympathy. If you get a good one, do what you can to hold on to her. The person who edited this book, Bodyworks, is just, I think, extraordinarily good. She did it. Just brilliant.
She's a great writer. I know her, Helen Hajdowski. She's done a brilliant book called Poets and Killers. You know, she's done a bunch of other great books. But I was curious to know if you could talk a bit more about working with her, because I do know her and her work. And, you know, when I first saw that she'd edited this book, I thought it was kind of a weird mashup, because her style is nothing like your style. It's very controlled, very... Often she'll work in anagrams or in, you know, found text. Like, she has a very precise approach in many respects. It's very at odds with what your approach is, but, you know, I could kind of see maybe where that might be a strength.
Well, I can give you some specific examples. There's a poem in here called, one of the body poems called Here. I'm thinking of, I can see if I can find it. A poem about back. Called, that one is a poem that's about the back. It's called Backgammon. Let me find it. It occurs somewhere in this book. Here it is.
124.
Great. Got it at the same time. I almost predictably working in a book called Body Works. Thought, well, what about body parts? And so I did several books about body parts, and one about the foot, one about the hand, for example. Here's about back. But here's where it goes. Before I read it, I'll tell you, this was about four times as long as this, what it now is. There was a pleasure I had. Here, another possibility, and this, and this, and this. A language is so filled with meaning and connections and leads that it's utterly inexhaustible. Here's the short version, Backgammon. It's all coming back to me. back when life was good, get back that loving feeling. We go a long way back, as far back as you can remember. Looking back, I might have done things differently. But now we're back. We're right back where we started. You can't hold back the rain. You can't hold back the sunrise. You can't hold back the wind. You are back where you belong, blinking back the tears. You have bounced back, back in the game. Sit back and enjoy it. Back in my arms. Sit back and relax. You are back, back home again, back home where you belong. I always knew you'd come back. You always come back. And
so what was the process of whittling that down to the shorter version?
Yeah. Well, she wisely said, look, this is just so long the way she put it was, could you see yourself reading this at a reading? Right? And I said, no, I can't. It'd be so long and exhausting probably that no, I couldn't do that. So I cut it way back. And I organized that. As you can see, I like the little narrative that emerges. As I was doing this, I drew out, I had that this before, I drew out those kind of refrain, you can't hold back, you can't hold back. And I was thinking partly of the theater of absurd, where you get that kind of language of the characters kind of feeling caught in a situation and wanting something more, but being frustrated or disappointed, let down in what's happening, about to happen, but expressing constantly their hope for that. We're waiting for Godot. When's he going to show up? Anytime he's coming. He's going to show up any day now. So the kind of, I find that quite moving, a kind of poetry in that kind of language.
Yeah, and the word back, as you say, it just has inherent in itself. We use it as a verb, we use it as a noun. It's got this, you know, connection to the body. We've got this sense of the past. You know, it's such a loaded, it can be such a loaded word. So as you say, like there's this, I would imagine also part of the process of cutting that poem down is in figuring out where can I make it more dense and kind of make it, you know, the meanings double and triple up. And then maybe kind of one line do the work of five lines in that way.
Actually, for me, I think it would be almost the opposite, of making it less dense. It was so thick, so heavy, just clotted and clogged, which I like doing. And even there it is. This is wonderful that the language can do and does this thing. Here it is. Look at this. But it's asking too much of your reader, probably. That sense of it being overburdened for a reader, I think was a very wise sense of that reading that I got from Helen. But mostly it was lightening the by shortening it and making fewer claims on the reader and on the trope.
Sure. Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. Wait, how do you but it's interesting because it's almost the opposite approach as what you do in that Ulysses poem, where it's very dense, it's very elusive. You can easily miss some of the allusions because it has such a density to it. I'm curious, you know, do you just sort of take one direction or the other depending on where the poem is going, or do you find yourself kind of reining yourself in or making decisions like that in the editing process primarily?
Well, I'm doing this all the time. I'm revising constantly and rewriting constantly. I would imagine that on an average, what a page that ends up in a book has probably gone through 20 changes. Sometimes they're very small toward the end. But many of them just disappear entirely. Say they're gone. I mean, hundreds of pages that are either, say, in scrap piles here somewhere or just thrown out entirely.
Do you have any sort of balance that you have, you try to strike between like drafting new stuff or revising older stuff? Or do you just have, just are you just kind of moving through the mass of paper until it starts to cohere? You know, I'm curious to know what your actual, what I always find so interesting about what you do is I have a hard time on one hand, I see exactly what you're doing, and it makes perfect sense to me. But on the other hand, I really wonder how that writing session is structured, if that makes sense. Like when you actually walk in your office door and you sit down, like, could you just walk me through like what that looks like before you kind of get up again? It sounds like madness to me on some level,
Yeah,
but yet you have a very controlled output in a certain way.
it was a kind of discipline in it. I think that, but it's I don't have any structures or sense of organization or schedules or whatever. I move from among projects within minutes, even that partly because the spark that to say, hey, that might go over there, or let me pull that out now, and I'll maybe work on that a little bit. So I'm moving very fluidly among different projects. So they're changing, and I move things between projects, saying, hey, that material might work over here.
How do you manage to do that, like just logistically? Like, do you have like a notebook where you're drafting? Do you have a computer like over here? Do you have like a second project on this screen? Like, I'm just curious what that
Exactly.
looks like.
I've got a big room. Yeah, very seriously, right? This is I'm not fooling here. I've got a big room, so I can move things around. I mean, I don't know if anybody any sense of this from the screen, but they're wops around here, and I've got to my left, immediate left, I've got a filing cabinet, and to my right behind, I've got a big filing cabinet, and I've got bookshelves all over the place. I've got a small desk here where I keep things. I keep these various shelves where I'm working on things that are right at hand. And I've got my computer has a big screen, so I can put up poems or drafts of poems side by side and allow me to say, okay, here's a new one work on, here's what it was before. What can I see them side by side? So that has been extremely useful to me. That's between working on a small screen, you can only see one thing, and are not able to access other materials so readily and so easily. So I pull things out. I do have folders where I throw things. Here's one out of my filing cabinet to the right. Here's stuff where I've been throwing things, which I call
Rants, I
read
think.
that rants.
That's great.
So there are piles of stuff thrown in here that maybe something may come up. I don't know. There are lots of them. So I'm starting to think that I actually might seriously fairly soon see about putting together a collection with a title, some such title, Rants and Ravings or whatever.
Well, how do you actually move from what you're doing then to like something as, complete and bounded and consistent? Like, there's a consistency in this book. It's not a slapdash affair, right? And I know, yes, you're saying some of that is your editor, but you're also an editor yourself. Is there a point where you kind of move into editor mode and you realize you're close enough that you want to lock it down?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So my counsel is often is when you're writing, be as promiscuous as you can. You don't have to show this to anybody. You say, well, this would be embarrassing. Well, perhaps it would be to you or somebody else, but this is stuff you're working on. These are, this is, what it is to be in the workshop. But you got to make some decisions along the way if you were thinking of or wanting to make this public, which is a whole another, not a whole other matter, but quite a different matter about how you would view the material and what you would do with it. So yeah, you're after the same thing. I want it to be interesting and live language.
Sure. So that's your sort of above all things, keep it in that interesting live.
Keep it alive. Keep it alive.
That's a great credo, and I think a good maybe place to end off. Everyone listening can pick up Dennis's new book, Body Works. Dennis Cooley, University of Calgary Press has published Body Works. Dennis has a lot of other great books out recently. He's been very prolific the last few years in particular. I really liked the book of poetry that you did with the photographer. I'm just blanking on the name all of a sudden.
Gibbous Moon.
Gibbous Moon, yes. And then you got another. Yeah, and then you also did another book with Moon in the title, Cold Press Moon, recently, which was another, I think, of your better books, certainly that you've done recently. It's probably my favorite book of yours at this point, is Gibbous, is kind of torn between Gibbous Moon and Cold Press Moon. And then you did one with At Bay Press that was really wonderful and has a beautiful cover. Again, I always mix the names up of your books because there's so many books.
Gibbous Moon.
That was At Bay, but also you did another At Bay Press book with the hummingbird on the cover.
Yeah, that was called The Muse Sings.
The Muse Sings, yes. So those are the four. Well, if I had to pick five books, which is hard, my top five of late for Dennis is, you know, Body Works out of U Calgary Press, The Muse Sings and Gibbous Moon out of At Bay Press, Cold Press Moon out of Turnstone Press, and then of course, you know, you got the classic that Dennis is probably best known for is Bloody Jack, and Alberta Press published it recently. Although my favorite Dennis book, honestly, if I had to pick one book of yours, I don't know if it's still in print right now, but the book you did for your mother, Irene, is probably my favorite of your books.
Yeah, good. I appreciate that. Yeah.
And is there anywhere, you know, where people can go and find, what's the best place for somebody to find you or your work online, Dennis? Is there one sort of spot where you can figure, get it all?
I don't have a website myself, so things are scattered. You can, lots of stuff is up there one way or another, little interviews or readings or whatever are out there on YouTube or whatever. And
take a look for Dennis Cooley. Google will tell you the best place to go, but I would say, you know, a great place to start is this most recent book here, Body Works. Thanks so much for talking to me, Dennis. It's always nice to see you and chat with you.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate this. It's been very, really good.
Great. Well, thanks so much. Keep up the good work and keep writing the wrong way.
You too.